Okay.
So the Royal Page shared the last 2 years, 1983 and 1984. Fall 82 to 83, fall 83 to 84. And then he fell into very bad health, and he didn't give shear after that. His brother of Aaron Soloveitchik began to give that shear. And so I was in the shear those last 2 years. In the total two years, I opened up my mouth twice to say something in shear. I was one of the younger guys in the class, and it was memorable. I remember what the two questions were, and I remember the answers he gave. So if you indulge me, I'll tell you what the two questions were. Rav used to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur time, just drop whatever the topic was. I learned with him Menachos, Shavuos, and Sota. Not the, your main Mesechtas that they learn in the Yeshiva world, but Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur time, he would drop that and do Inyanim of the Yom Neroi. Sometimes from the Gemara, sometimes just Hashkafa. Even now, since then, Talmidim of his have written really scores and scores of Sfarim just from their notes from Shir. Right? So now they've published Machzorim with all of his Machshavas for Yom Neroi. You've seen them. There's a Rosh Hashanah and a Yom Kippur Machzor filled with excellent material to enhance your Yom Neroi experiences. So one year he was talking about the Zeros and when they take place, the Rosh Hashanah Zera, the Yom Kippur Zera, you know, why do we need 2 days for atonement and forgiveness and the like. And the Rav quoted the Gemara in the Sechus Rosh Hashanah, Dav Tezayin, that says that the Gzar Din comes through on Rosh Hashanah if you're unequivocally on one side. The Tzaddik gets his judgment for life, the Rasha gets his judgment for death. And what do we have Aseres Mitzvah for? For Beinu. That's a Gemara. So this is where if you wanted to say something, you had to push your way in. Right? It was like you're making your way into the turnoff lane from at the end without waiting on that long line. So I got my question in there, and the question was, so why is the greeting between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur Gemar Chasima Tova? Essentially, while the Gemara says you should consider yourself a Beinuni, why should I consider you a Beinuni? If I say Gemar Chasima Tova, I'm essentially saying you still have some Gemara to take care of. Rather, the felicitation between the Shun and Kippur should be, I'm sure you had your Gemara already. Right? You get what you... Right? You're a Tzaddik. I can call myself a Beinuni, but why am I calling you a Beinuni? So the Rav answered me in Yiddish and said, Halavai b'necha Beinuni. Which means in Yiddish, oh, if only I could be a Beinuni. In other words, I'm okay if you call me a Beinuni. I don't think he answered the question. I don't know, but that's what he said to me. That's the few words I got back from the Rav. The other question was a Gemara in Shavuos that talks about the bowing that we make when we enter the Beis HaMikdash. And he said that there was a specific ruling that he derived from, I believe it was Iran, that where you, when you daven Shmoneh Esrei, you should not move to a different spot in your Shmoneh Esrei. You should be staying stationary in your Shmoneh Esrei. So this is my kasha. If you can think about it, it's like a... There's a Tosfos in the Sechus Brachos, in the first parak, that talks about Rabbi Akiva and how he gesticulated violently in his daven Shmoneh Esrei. And it may be an exaggeration, I'm sure it is, because the Gemara says that when Rabbi Akiva would begin davening at one part of the room, he would gesticulate so much that by the time he finished his Shmoneh Esrei, he was in the diagonal opposite side of the room. Right? You can picture such a thing, right? So here's my kasha to our salvation. Was Tostes's objection to that type of gesticulation was, why is he bowing so much? It's on the Gemara that says you should only bow at the beginning of the end of the first bracha and the beginning of the end of Modim. But other than that, we should not be bowing unless you're the king or the Kohen Gadol, right? Kohen Gadol in the beginning of each bracha, the king at the beginning and the end of each bracha. But everybody else, only four times is one answer. Tosfos's kasha was, how could he gesticulate so much as to get in? So my kasha to the Rav was, according to your what you just said, you have to say it in third person. If the Rebbe just said, this Ran, surely Tosfos should have asked, why is he ending up in a part of the room where he didn't start? Right? So, and my question was, does this mean that Tosfos disagrees with this Ran? Otherwise, he should have had two objections for Rabbi Akiva, who's gesticulating so much. One, he's davening like the Melech and the Kohen Gadol, and he's neither. And two, he's ending up in a different part of the room. So the Rav's answer to me was, Rabbi Akiva couldn't help himself. And then he went on. Again, I didn't think I got an answer. Just tell me, yeah, you're right. He disagrees with you. All right, anyway, that's it. Those are my two questions. In 2 years, I asked two questions. And that was it. But since my Charusa was his Shamus, I had a chance to learn with him privately you come in and learn in his, sometimes in his apartment. There I had a chance to schmooze a little sometimes. Okay? Yes?
What was the Rav's personality like?
I think he had a pretty good sense of humor. He was sometimes funny. He was very. I think he was a shiva chassid. I have someone in my shul now who went to Maimonides. He's older than I am, so he had the Rav used to teach seniors in the 70s, and he says he was very humorous. He was very open. He would allow the seniors to ask him one question. Everybody in the class would ask one question. And he said in his year, people were asking him like small questions. Like, how should I make tea on Shabbos and stuff like that? And he said, I'm disappointed by your questions. He said afterwards, you want to know what's on my mind? What question I would ask? What's on my mind is that I'm worried. Remember, he's saying this in about the year 1976, 75. I'm worried that the advances in science will not take into account morality, right? And I'm worried that those in the Torah world are not going to be sensitive enough to the advances of science. That's what he told. That's what this guy told me. He said to his senior class. I don't know if he said that to every class. But have you ever heard of this? Like a joke out there that talks about. I've seen it like in a big whole treatment of like a tshuva of what a Christmas tree would look like if it was a halachic. Did you see something like that?
Yeah.
Look it up. You can probably Google it and find it. Christmas tree in halacha. So I just found. So I speak Yiddish, and Rav Soloveitchik is some people prepared for this. They tape. They make movies. Called Super 8 movies at the time, of Rav Soloveitchik's shiurim when he was in the 50s and the 60s. So they're all coming on the internet now, and they're almost all in Yiddish. So I just was listening to one, and he actually did. He said the joke. He said, I can picture what the halacha would be like if we had Christmas trees. And he goes through the whole funny thing. Right? He said you would have to be a certain shear, and you would have to know that the shuloshim, and sort of like a little measure. So, because he had certainly the dryness of the brisker. You know, briskers are all very mathematical about their observance, but he was also a shtickel chassid. And I think he would want to go down as someone with a very sensitive, emotional attachment to Judaism that he claims he got from his mother. Okay. His father was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. His grandfather was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. The Brisker Rav, we remembered. And, this was, at 5 years old, they were given, he speaks about this. This is your readings, you'll see. What's called a mathematical model of Jewish observance. A mathematical model doesn't care too much about what you think. 3 + 2 is one answer. Right? And 3 + 2 doesn't have to wonder what it's like to be an odd number. Right? In other words, you have to eat a certain amount of maror at the Seder, you have to eat a certain amount of matzah at the Seder, you have to know what's the shear for this violation, what's the shear for that observance, what. Right, so the Briskers tend to be the criticism is that they're only interested in the mathematical part of Judaism. That's not true. The Rav wrote equally about the aesthetic model of Jewish observance, how it changes you, what makes you feel when you wrap yourself in a talis and you shake yourself, you shake the lulav and esrog, service to the Creator, right? I think that, I want to get into an introduction to what the course is going to do, but I think there's something so beautiful about the point that the Rav makes about the mathematical and the aesthetic levels of Judaism that it connects to this week's parsha, right? When Moshe and Aaron are described in the parsha, you're familiar, it says who Moshe and Aaron. And then it says afterwards, who Aaron and Moshe? Right? Look it up in the beginning of Parshas Vayera. Okay, when Moshe's parents and Moshe's background is introduced, it just says Vayera Kish, he base lady, but he cut his boss lady. You don't know who anyone is. He's got a sister who's looking after him, right? No one's named. Right? I don't want to get off on a tangent now. I just want to concentrate on this little baby. Right, the first chance we get, we're going to give you his family background. And we do. We get it in this week's parsha, right? So when Rashi sees who Moshe Aaron and then who Aaron and Moshe, Rashi writes, this is to teach us that they are shikulim. Shikulim. Can someone give me a good English translation of shikulim? Hey, be careful. Don't just say equal right away. No one's equal to Moshe. What would you say they are?
Considerations.
Shikulim. Moshe and Aaron are shikulim. What's a shekel? What is mishkol?
Yes. Like weighted proportionally similar.
Okay. If you wanted, those are three good English words. Would you agree that the word balanced might complement?
I usually teach to not here. This is I don't know if it's better, but that's what it would be a lot.
So not
I'll make the point further with the mathematical and the aesthetic. So it's an argument that Rashi makes that because Moshe objected so vociferously at the sneh, Rashi says for a whole week, right? And Rashi seems to want to create a setting that perhaps wants to make a tikkun for some of the bad things of Sefer Bereishis, namely, where a younger brother, right, exceeds his older brother, his older sibling, starting with Hebel and Kain, right, and Yitzchak and Yishmael and Yaakov and Esau, and Yosef and his brothers, right, and even it's like it becomes such a trend that Yaakov just crosses over his hand and he tells Yosef. I know you object to this, but this is Sefer Bereishis. I have to favor your younger child, right? Kiviyochol. And Menashe doesn't object, but Yosef does. And Menashe seems to accept that fate. Maybe the Menashe saves Sefer Bereishis, right? Because I have to resolve this sibling kind of situation, right? Right? By my lights, Hashem did not accept Cain's korban, not because it was inferior. He deserves credit for coming up with the idea to thank this maker for his bounty. Right? By my lights, and this is in my, I have a sefer called Parsha Shlemi. In Parsha's Bereishis, I write that Now, the proof I give is that when Cain is given a pep talk by God, and he says, Cain, try harder. You can succeed just like your brother. Right? You can be in charge of your emotions. I know you're angry. I know you're depressed. But you're in charge. Right? And then the next person he kills his brother. What's with that? What was the point of God's pep talk? And God, excuse me, I don't mean to be chutzpahdik, but I have tested third graders with an unequivocal statement that could take up the two psukim that would have convinced Cain to not kill his brother the next day. Why were you not convinced? So convincing? Usually, I do this, that's with third and fourth graders, and they say that God should have given him some kind of stick or carrot, right? Some kind of incredible pain, and say, Cain, I know you want to kill your brother. This is what you can experience for the rest of your life if you touch him tomorrow. He wouldn't have killed him then. Or give him some kind of incredible pleasure. Cain, you see that massage chair over there? Get in. I want to show you what that's going to feel like. You can have that chair and 100 more like it and swimming pools and it if you make up with your brother. Right? Well, come on. Well, God says, you can do better, Cain. You're in charge of your feelings. Touch him, shalbo. Not even rule over heaven. You can rule over your feelings. And just do your best. And then he goes and kills his brother. And the pasuk where he kills him is missing what he says. V'yomer Cain al hevel achiv, v'yibi yosom basadeh, v'yokom Cain al hevel achiv v'yargeim. What's with that? What did he say? I suggest to you that he went to hevel to try to follow God's advice. God told me to try harder, but I don't know how. What did you do to get his attention? And Hevel didn't answer. Hevel said, Cain, you taught me very well, my older brother. How did he teach him? This is what I write in the book, that the reason why Cain's korban was not accepted is because he didn't include his brother the day he brought his korban. He should have told Hevel, you need God for your wool, I need God for my crops. Let's bring a korban together. Why did he bring his korban alone? Because he wanted alone to be accepted by God. Get it? So Hevel saw what he did. He got found out. I don't know. He was China and he got the secrets. He sent a spy to see what Hevel, what Cain did. Right? So he did it. He did it better. So I'm not going to share what you didn't want to share with me. And Cain didn't take kindly to that. I'm not saying Hevel got what he deserved. But you know, God, you're God. Why did you bring in? Why did you usher in this jealousy and this competition? Because God says, I'm not giving anyone a free ride. You've got to compete. Yeah. But you also got to cooperate. I'm not accepting Cain for not cooperating. All right? So now you go through all this. Imagine how different human history would have been if Cain had included his brother that first day. Then Hevel would have said to Cain, Cain, don't bring that. That's me pre-Hagamah. Bring your best fruits. I'm bringing my best wool. I'll bring my best, my sheep. Best sheep. Horos don't know much of that. Right? So brotherhood suffers throughout this first book. Can anyone think from the storyline that's related to this parsha that it's mashma that Moshe's apprehension at the Sneh, yeah, it's about his own abilities, his own limitations, his own impediments, how the people might accept him and might not accept him. But when he agrees to go, is only after God tells him, finish my sentence, that Aaron is coming out to meet you and he's happy for you. That's a tikkun for sacred orations, right? So Rashi says that at first Moshe was supposed to be doing the whole business himself. He was supposed to be doing Gadol. Remember where Rashi gets that? Because it says, your brother Aaron Halevi is coming out to meet you. Why are you calling him Aaron Halevi? He's Aaron Kohen. Not yet. You were supposed to be the Kohen. But you know what, Moshe? You feel your limitations? Okay, I'm going to put both those things I'm describing as the Rav right now in two different bodies. Which one is Moshe, which one is Aaron? Should be obvious.
You're saying Moshe would be Cain?
Don't do Cain and Hevel right now. Do the mathematical and the aesthetic.
So like labels?
Yeah, the label of who, the mathematical model is the one who's, and that's why I like to.
That should be the face, or it should be like the work. The leader.
Use the terminologies I used, and I think that's why we call this a religious leader and there's a spiritual leader. The religious leader is someone who is there to teach you religion, which is sometimes dry and mathematical. Is this okay? Is the corner is too far off? Is this filling wide enough? Is the mezuzah kosher? Is it above 100? Is it above 200? These are numbers. These are mathematics, and they're dry. But then there's a spiritual leader who is engages in pomp and ceremony, get up. Right? We're never told what Moshe wears, but it's pretty clear that Aaron is wearing these real pompous get-ups. With 12 gems and all these kind of purple and gold and the trims and bells and that, right? Okay, in order to show that I need a Moshe and an Aaron. Rashi suggests that Moshe was supposed to be both at the same time. I'm suggesting to you that my experience of Soloveitchik is that he was. I don't know if he would have... Look, the Vilna Gaon, his original name was HaChosid Mivilna. Did you know that? HaChosid Mivilna, before there was a movement called Hasidus that he fought valiantly against. Right? Hasidus today is what it is because of the Vilna Gaon fought against it. Right? And made sure it stayed within the framework of not going too far off. So that's what I would like to suggest about my experience with the experiences of those I've spoken to, is that he was profoundly connected, of course, to the brisker mathematical model of Torah observance, which he says he got from his father, right? The Rav's grandfather of Chaim, the son of the Beis Halevi, for whom the Rav of our course. Is named after Yosef Dov Soloveitch, heard of the Beis Halevi. So there's a story that Rav Chaim was he's about 5 years old, learning with his father, the Beis Halevi, and somehow it happened. This is the way the story is told: that both his mother and his father asked him to do something at the same time, and he did the thing for his father first. So Rav Chaim, so Rav Beis Halevi said, why did you bring for your mother? Why didn't you bring for your mother before me? And he said, well, I seem to recall, it's a Gemara in Kiddushin, that, mommy has to honor and respect you, and I have to respect both of you. So I figure, the halacha says that if the parents are not married, the parents are divorced, then the child can choose whichever one he wants, right? But if they're married, you do your father first. So this is what the Beis Halevi said to a 5-year-old kid. Listen to this. He said, maybe you should always do for your mother first, because your mother is your mother from Eidus. Someone saw your mother give birth to you. I'm your father only through Chazaka. Rov Bidilos Acharabah. Right? So maybe a person should always honor his mother, because your mother is more your mother than your father is your father. One is Eidus, one is Chazak. Here. So the 5-year-old thought for a second. He said, "Dad, how would that be more respect for my mother if I got her the water before I got it for you, on the basis that maybe you're not my father?" Amazing. How would that be honoring my mother if the basis for doing the thing for her first is on the basis that perhaps you're not my father? Okay, there's so many stories like this about the Briskers, and truth be told, I have not really, there's so many written by, especially the daughters. Right? Soloveitchik's aunt wrote one of them, sister. There were all these books written about their stories that are told about them. And maybe I'll share what I wanted to with you here and there. Okay. All right. So that is somewhat by way of introduction. You've all heard of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, right? So right up the block here, it's the school I went to as a first to eighth grade. It's called Yeshiva Soloveitchik. It's now Schottenstein Center. I went to Yeshiva Soloveitchik, went to MTA, I went to YU, Revel, and Sneva, and I've been teaching here since the spring of 1983. So every morning since 1967, when I get up to go to work, except for a year in Israel, I get up to, that's 55 years, right here, this block. Just a little L. Right? It's a nice neighborhood. So I went to Yeshiva Soloveitchik, but a few blocks down is a school named after Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. It's called Breuers. Anybody know Washington Heights? Right? It's called Breuers. So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was born in 1808. And amazingly, he had a child very late in life. He had two families. And his granddaughter, someone born in 1808, his granddaughter just died a few years ago. I knew her because her father was the first rabbi of the shul that I served in. His name was Hillel Klein. Right? So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's granddaughter just passed away. She lived in Yonkers. She was 105. And Shimshon Raphael Hirsch lived in Germany at a time of great religious upheaval in Germany. I'm sure you know what history is going on in 1840 in Germany, and all these Jewish groups that want to change Saturday back to Sunday, Saturday to Sunday, maybe possibly even Wednesday. And biblical criticism was raging, right? The criticism of the Torah that was always written by five different authors, and that Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov never actually lived, and they were fabricated by someone who wanted to make a connection to the land. Well, this is what Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was dealing with. Okay, he is considered the originator of what's called neo-orthodoxy. Present orthodoxy to a community that is dropping like flies and embracing reform, right? So some of the early reforms, the reform today wouldn't be recognized by the reform then, but still, they were bringing mixed pews, men and women sitting together, they were using into the shuls, musical instruments for Shabbos, right? The organs to be more like churches. Okay? So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch presented orthodoxy in Perushim to Tanakh, in sermons, and he's really very, very well regarded in this realm. I would like to suggest to you, you've all heard of him, right? No? Okay. So the Rav Soloveitchik had some I would like to say that in the 50s he was a trailblazer in certain ways. I'm going to just mention one or two today, and we're going to spend the semester looking for other examples of this, but one is really significant. In 1950, the American Jewish Yearbook, have you ever heard of this? American Jewish Yearbook, it was printed by World Jewish Congress. American Jewish Yearbook predicted that by the year 2000, there will be no Orthodox Jews in America. They will either become Reform or conservative or move to Israel.
And what was this?
1950. The now defunct American Jewish Yearbook wrote that by the year 2000, there will be no Orthodox Jews in America. I would like to suggest that he didn't do this alone, no doubt. It was Aaron Cutler. There was Lakewood, there was many different, Chaim Berlin, and many yeshivas that helped to sustain the orthodoxy besides this school. But I think that the effort that the Rav made in a certain type of education that was manifest in a big chiddush in the late 60s, early 70s, was the education of women. And that, in the 1950, there were very few options for girls, so practically nothing. I mean, it was basically basic opera. Now, I don't need to say here that Dress Elevation was the origin or the originator of basic opera. No, it was women who were doing that. But to proliferate and to have Rabbanim who were teaching in this school be involved in that, right? I think was something the Rav gave his imprimatur, which turned into what he started to do at Stern College. It was to teach women Torah Shabbat. Okay, famous pictures of this. I think Rabbi Willard was in the picture. Rabbi Saul Berman and Rabbi Avi Weiss. Right, some of these people went in very different directions over time.
Rabbi
Lam. I think Rabbi Lam was in the picture too. Okay, so Rabbi Willock still teaches this semester, is there? So I think that is an important element of the Rav's hashivus that he gave to education for you. Not just women, but girls, first grade. My mother did not have my mother went to public school. She didn't know yeshivas at the time. She was born in 1928. No, nothing. I think in the 1940s, nothing. But she had three younger sisters who all went to Beit Yaakov. Right? Okay, so we'll talk about the basic certain innovations. Today, I would like to close today's class with some Shimshon Raphael Hirshian elements that you probably learned in high school. You know the high schools like to assign. I know some that I've been involved with always assigned over the summer for juniors or even sophomores to read certain articles of Rav Soloveitchik in preparation of the next year or something like that. And you know, they're all girls' schools now that I'm thinking of it. So I don't know. Yeah, which you guys didn't attend. All right, so but here is what it is. All right, and it simultaneously dealt with evolution, because as evolution was becoming such an obvious element of the origins of us Homo sapiens, right? So to consider that people who are like us, as opposed to, let's say, Neanderthals or something else, are only on this earth for 5,700 some odd years, was mocked in the scholarly world. Right. How does Rav Soloveitchik deal? So Rav Soloveitchik say, listen, we could just say, tough, you're wrong. This earth is only 5,700 years old, and then I don't care what you think. But that wasn't the rule. So evolution, number one. Two, biblical criticism. Biblical criticism is founded upon the following foundations as follows. One, why are there so many different names for God in the Bible? Especially Elohim and Yud-Kevokim. Two, why does the Bible contradict itself so often? Three, why does the Bible repeat itself so often? There are other foundations, these are the main ones. So this is where Rav Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, who had a doctorate from the Sorbonne, by the way, so did the Lubavitch Rebbe and the Chaim Leibowitz, were in the same class, at were in grade at one point in the Sorbonne. And I actually have Rav Soloveitchik's doctoral thesis in German, in philosophy, from Berlin University. He tried out to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and did not succeed, so he came to America, to this school. And the reading that I know, I've seen it so often, is to read what Rav Soloveitchik said about Bereishis Perek Aleph and Bereishis Perek Bet. Why does one appear as Elohim and one appears as Yudke Vavke? And then, and it's Hashem Elohim. And why the repetition? Bereishis Perek Beis just repeats the stories of creation with changes. Why? You already told me about creation. Why are you repeating it in paraphrase? So, does this ring a bell to anybody? Adam 1 and Adam 2?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Soloveitchik, which one was he trying to purport to a greater extent? His treatment of the biblical criticism element? Why different names of God? Why repeat the gracious? Why contradict some elements of the order of gracious? Right? And then the Rav ingeniously connected this while responding to the biblical critics, explained his thesis regarding evolution without contradicting anything that the evolutionists are saying, while explaining how Adam HaRishon can actually have lived only 5,000 some odd years ago. Right? And this was his explanation, is that there are two Adams. We're descended from Adam too. Adam too has a wife. Adam too misses that wife. Adam 1 has many wives. Hundreds, maybe. He goes around spreading his seed with many, many different, like animals do. He doesn't go back to that wife. Right? You're beginning to see a trend here? What's going on? Okay, we have ancestors that go back. But nowhere in Perek Aleph does it say that there is the breath of the Ruach Elohim that flows into the lungs of that Adam. No, that's the second Adam. This is not a repetition or a contradiction. Right? That Adam only understands Elohim as Teva. This Teva, this Elohim, this Gematria, Teha Teva. Right? Elohim is judgmental, mathematical, if you will. Right? And there's no relationship between man and his maker there. Right? Even though there is an element of Tzelem Elohim to that, because that's still different than animals. But the one who is so different that he can name those animals is only in Perek Beis. He only gets introduced to a wife in Perek Beis. Right? This is where we want to know that you are going to show how different you are than the animals by naming them, by staying with, right? By v'dovak b'ishto v'hayu l'basar echad. Animals are also basar echad when they procreate, right? But then they separate. The chiddush of basar echad. This is Rashi. Very precious. Rashi says, "Vayula basar echad" means that after you finish copulating with this mate of yours, you stay one flesh. You keep a one relationship. You don't run to another one and impregnate another woman or get impregnated by another man, like they do in the animal world, right? I remember I was watching. What is it called when this child is raised by a wolf? I was watching with one of my grandchildren. Jungle Boy or something. Remember the wolf, she has a husband, right? And the husband is killed by this tiger or something, and she, no emotion. But when the tiger grabs one of her kids, she goes crazy. A wolf does have an instinct to look after her young, but has no instinct whatsoever to connect to the one that pregnant her. You hear? The Torah says, "I want you to be different. I want you to connect to that woman. And I want you to stay with her. And I want her to stay with you." That's Adam too. We could be descended from this other type of Adam, if you will, that goes back 100,000 years. Right? But the Adam that Hashem says has a soul and a soul mate, you get it, is So this was his way of connecting. I know you might say, wait, I have my kashas on this. Okay, good. In some places, in some Torah worlds, they do. And join. But the Rav had to walk in certain areas that Shipshur Paul Hirsch felt he had to in Germany in 1840 and 1850. And the Rav, I think, delighted that in that realm very successfully.
So you're saying that in Bereshit Aleph, that everything Adam there is all Adam 1, and that's all classic, pre-Homo sapien, like, not divine, its own, like, entity kind of?
Yeah, but you have to be careful, because does this test every scrutiny? Because Perek Aleph does say, not so dumb, it's on name of the same. That's in Perek Aleph. That's what I'm saying. Right? Mm-hmm. So that is a demus of Hashem, but it's not. But it doesn't have the spirit of Hashem in it yet. Not ve'pach ba'pav ruach nishmas chayim. That's a fair thing. So the Rav had to glide very carefully in between these two atoms. And so it's interesting if you would look in the two prokim together and then read what were, I don't know, some of you did seem to be familiar with these two atoms, right? It's an interesting. I can hear an argument on both sides. What was the impetus for this brilliant connection of responding to the evolution problem together with the biblical criticism problem? Was it first parshanut and then the worry about evolution, or was it to work to deal with evolution and then which one did he care about more? My sense is he cared about the scientists more. To heck with the biblical critics. I don't care. I don't need to answer them. But in the end, it was a profound answer to it. Right? The earliest references to biblical criticism it was a French writer named Jean Ostrek in the 1790s. So he came up with this great chiddush. Wow, repetition is not repetition. It's two different authors, two different sources that an Ezra kind of figure many years later put together. Right? And what's fascinating is that the early proponents of this kind of theory of biblical reading were profoundly anti-Semitic. The purpose was to show that Judaism is a fabricated religion, not much more than 50 or 100 years older than Christianity. And everything is a fabrication. It's all fake. Of course, archaeology has proven that to be nonsense. Right? Are you following the last few weeks even of archaeology, what's been found recently? Incredible stuff. Specific stuff about Chizkiyahu, Bais Rishon. Chizkiyahu and the things that are in Tanakh. I knew always knew about Chizkiyahu's tunnels, but they just found coins with names of Yehuda kings. Amazing stuff. Right? What pains me is how in the before conservative biblical studies world, they just jump in hook, line, and sinker about accepting biblical criticism. It's very painful because the origins of biblical criticism, again, you know what it means, right? That the Bible, we explain contradictions, we explain multiple names of God, we explain repetitions as the different sources that were put together by some figure, call him Ezra, call him whatever you want. And the ones proposing this were profoundly anti-Semitic. They were trying to show that Israel is a god of religion, Judaism is a fabrication, not, you know, certainly. So to me it's like dogmatic to fight against this. And the Rav made a valiant attempt to do so in this manner. Okay, so please make sure that you walk out of class with this page here. Right?